Thursday, football fans, and welcome to the Soccer Central podcast. James Sharman here, as always, joined alongside John Molinaro on what is a huge week in the future of our game. Yes, indeed, it is FIFA election week. On Friday, we'll know what brave leader will take the mantle and carry us into the future, a future free of corruption.
Just a
scandal.
Just a bit of sarcasm dripping from your lips there.
A little bit, you might say. I'm a tad cynical, as I think most somewhat intelligent people are. We're going to get to this really shortly. Also today, though, we're talking some Canadian development with Rob Gale, the coach of the U20s, and a very well-spoken man, been around the world in his travels, and has some great perspective on how to make a successful nation. We'll get to the Champions League football as well, I'm sure, at some point. Yep. And Antonio Conte may be on the way to Chelsea. Interesting.
That'd be interesting.
J-Mo's eyes light up. But to start with, it's all about the elections. A man that's written about this on his Forbes.com column just this week is our good friend, Bobby McMahon. Hello, Bobby.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
I'm doing great. So here we are. We're a day out of the new elections. Now, before they announced the new president to replace the fallen Sepp Blatter, they will, of course, vote in the reforms, which have been announced. Now, I'm assuming they'll be voted in. If not, God help us all, because I think chaos will ensue. But I'm looking at these candidates, Bobby. Sheikh Salman is the favorite right now, which in itself is a bit terrifying. Gianni Infantino is the second favorite. He's one of Platini's boys. When I look at these candidates, they're all from within FIFA, except for Tokyo Sexwell, who, well, we'll find out about him tomorrow, I guess. But given what we know, given what needs to be done, surely the only way forward is to get a completely independent voice, independent candidate. But he's just not there right now.
It's not. It's a kind of uninspiring bunch. Really, and it's you kind of get the you look over them and you kind of feel that it's sort of warmed over. You got Infantino who's there because Platini's not. You've got the Sheikh Salman, who I think has missed the biggest opportunity a lot. I think the opportunity he missed. How about this one, guys? Why didn't he run under the slogan of "I'll give you a fair shake"?
Brilliant.
You know, like that would you would have thought the marketing guys would have got to that, right?
Absolutely. But I mean, isn't he just another Blatter, though? I mean, he's one of Blatter's mates.
But this is, you know, you mentioned the reforms, James, and this is where none of these candidates inspire me, and I doubt have inspired many people. But we're so focused on the election, but I do believe that the reform package, although it's not gone as far as some people would want. The bottom line is when you look at some of these the governance issues around organisations, you're always going to have people who think it's gone too far. You're going to have people who think it's not gone far enough. But if this reform package does take and it is approved, and I agree with you, if it's not approved, then we're really into a shambles. I think we're into stage one of complete meltdown. And it then will take a life of its own, and FIFA, as we know it, probably will not exist in 3 or 4 years' time. But if the reform proposals do take root, then the thing we've got to understand here is the position that Blatter and Haviland operated from essentially will change, the character will change substantially, and in many ways the most important person in FIFA will not become the president, but it'll actually become this general secretary that will be hired to replace Volkey, who's, you know, another one that's fallen by the wayside. So in many ways, we're kind of focused on FIFA as it is just now and thinking that, well, the new president will come in and it will be like it was before. If the reform proposals are implemented as stated, then that presidential role becomes a lot different and a lot less involvement in the day-to-day operations, which has led to the political situation in FIFA where politics have always trumped good business. And then the business side of the operation then falls to the general secretary, who will have a lot more control. So in many ways, whoever's elected, it is going to be a change in doing business, because the whole organization will have to do a major shift.
And with that in mind, Bobby, talking about sort of, you know, the reforms taking place, and that if they do take place, then how the landscape changes. And appreciating your previous comment about not being particularly inspired about the candidates, But within this new framework, who do you think, and of the candidates that are up for the position, who do you think best fits?
You know, like, I hate to say it, I think he's missed a very big opportunity. Prince Ali really did quite well against Blatter in the head-to-head in May, even though he dropped out after the first round and we had all the goings-on with the rest. I'm not sure I think he's almost suffered from the fact that he did run against Blatter, because he's been around and he's been spouting the same message, that it's kind of, it's worn a little bit thin. But of all five of them, I would, you know, find it, on one hand, find it difficult to nominate somebody who's part of a royal family to run be president of a world organization. But out of all of them, I think he's deserves some credit for the consistency of message and the feeling that he might be the best one to lead the organization.
Yeah, I agree with you. There was a report yesterday that FIFA's demanding a look at all the potential winning speeches before they're even said. They want to make sure that these candidates and the winning president is very much on message, so to speak. Is that an example of how depowered this job's going to be, and how it's going to be far more of a committee, a commission-based decision-making process?
Well, I think you're spot on there, James. I think this is much more in the I don't know if you guys have seen the FIFA video. It's actually quite a good video about the watch you through the changes to the organisation. But they're right up front in terms of the video and saying they talk about the president being much more of an ambassadorial role, almost like in some countries where you've got a president and a prime minister. You know, president is very much the head of state, but it's ceremonial. But the actual the workings and the operations and the mechanics of the organisation and our governments really fall to the prime minister kind of position, and that's a parallel with the general secretary. So I think you do see this kind of change, and this would be quite substantial, because we haven't really seen that in the last 40, 50 years since Havelange took over and really took the reins and started forging FIFA in the way that he wanted to operate. The general secretary has really been the minion kind of position, and I see that changing.
Bobby, last May, when the previous FIFA presidential vote was held, this is when all the sort of hell broke loose and all the arrests came down, and there was the knock on the door in the early morning in Switzerland, and people dragged out of their hotels. Do you get a sense that I don't know, that there might be more of that tomorrow?
I think we've got to take that into consideration, but I think there's also probably some thought process in terms of law enforcement saying they've had a run at this twice. Now FIFA are in a position where they are voting on reforms. Do they really want to scuttle that potential vote and be that kind of sideshow to this, or have they got the main actors and feel like they can get to the other ones in a more timely manner rather than a showcase? And certainly that May one, it was logistically it made sense because everybody was gathered in Zurich for that meeting. But I say they've kind of had these two waves of arrest now, and I think there's a possibility, but I'd be surprised if they did it for a third time.
Maybe there will be a shakedown though.
Charms.
Would it be a natural hat trick?
I think it would be.
All right, that's enough of the puns.
But I mean, Bobby, you know, what do you want to hear from the winning candidate? I mean, I don't want a guy coming up there and, you know, jumping on his high horse and saying, under my stewardship, I will rid this corruption from our sport. This has got to be a slow process, I imagine, very gradual. Go ahead.
No, sorry, carry on. You finish, James.
You know, I'm just saying, you know, it's going to be a very slow, gradual process. And I think anyone that expects overnight FIFA to be clean is kidding themselves. No matter who wins tomorrow, may not be the guy in charge when we can really say we trust FIFA once again.
Yeah, because you've got two situations. You've got this, and I'm not defending FIFA in any way, but it's been labelled as FIFA corruption. But many of the rests have been about CONMEBOL and CONCACAF corruption. So you've got kind of two elements, the corruption that's gone on in terms of World Cup bids, and then you've got this kind of second level of confederation corruption that you've got to clean up as well. So you've kind of got this there's a limit to what FIFA can actually control and and perhaps clean up. But there's one word you said there, James, that I thought was very, very significant. You used the word steward. And that's where I think these organizations, the FIFA in particular, the IAAF have gone through the same situation, and the IOC went through it as well, is the people that got in the positions of power forgot that they were actually stewards of the organization. They didn't become the organization, and the organization didn't become them. They started operating as tin-pot dictators instead of seeing themselves as somebody who was put in a position of power for a temporary period of time to the benefit of the game and the sport. So if somebody stood up there tomorrow and said, use the word steward and stewardship, I feel a hell of a lot better about them being in charge than some of the tin-pot dictators we've had up to now.
Bobby, how much of, how to word this? You know, the FIFA, obviously what happened last May, it sort of sent the organization into a tailspin, for lack of a better word. Yeah. I mean, how much is what's going to happen tomorrow going to not change the direction, but maybe, you know, give them a little bit of relief of that from that and just improve the overall general public perception that people have of the organization?
I think that there's going to continue to be a significant level of cynicism, and it's quite warranted given the goings on over the last 30 to 40 years. You're not just going to allow that to dissipate, and that's not going to dissipate in a matter of a few weeks or a few months or even, as James pointed out, a couple of years. But I think at least if the reform measures go through, I think a group of reasonably fair-minded people will say, well, it's a move in the right direction, and at least there's a governance structure in place now that makes some sense. We've got term limits. We've got ethics checks. We've got more women involved. We've got an elected council that comes from the confederations. There's a number of things there that certainly seem to be good ideas and seem to be based on best practices. Particularly the term limits become very, very important as well. Or perhaps maybe even one of the most important things. But if you've got that decent governance structure, then at least you've given yourself a chance to succeed. Essentially, you had a situation with FIFA. The IOC went through this before, and the IAAF are going through it now. You basically have governance structures for these organizations that were based on a model that was perhaps early 20th century at best, that never contemplated the kind of money that's involved in sport and the power that sport has in this world. So they continued to work with these governance structures because it suited them, and they just, you know, weaved their way around any obstacles and made tons of money and broke good governance rules and best business practices along the way. But if you've got that good governance structure and it's enforced, then that's obviously going to be helped. So, you know, it's a move in the right direction. We'll still have to wait a number of years to see how effective it is, but it does give them a chance to succeed, I think.
So it's about modernization of the process more than anything.
Yeah, like you look at some of the stuff, FIFA statutes and the way FIFA was organized, you know, you had Sepp Blatter now and again dropping in an ethics commission and then cutting the nuts off the ethics commission as soon as he put it in place. Like, you just, you know, they were always maneuvering and finagling around things. And the presidential role that Havelange created for himself and Blatter inherited was such an all-powerful one, even though there was the executive, the power that the president had in terms of divvying up appointments to committees and rolling out money and rolling out the expense accounts. God, it was a politician's dream. All in the process of building up a $1.5 billion reserve fund. My God, any politician in the world would love that situation. You should never get thrown out of that job, but Blatter managed it.
But they couldn't afford to play Pertini 2 million back in, when was it, 2001 or whenever it is.
Yeah, because, you know, they only had like 600 million in the bank at that time.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm fascinated how this the independence and this commission will be auditing the decisions made by the council to hear about this. That sounds very, a lot of potential there, but we'll see. I want to know your initial thoughts when you heard that Blatter Pertini had their bans reduced to 6 years from 8 years due to services to the game in their past. I pissed myself.
Yeah, I giggled a lot. It should have been worse than that, though. I've got, you know, like, services to the game. Could you maybe be a bit more specific there?
Seriously.
It's you're lucky you're not serving time for it. not probably surprised, though, in as much as that's kind of stunned. And once again, to try and be fair on this, I think my guess is what they're trying to do there is, okay, let's cut the ban a little bit, because let's stop then the next appeal, which was the court arbitration. So they want to kind of bring this to some sort of end. They want to, you know, put them in a position where Platini and Blatter can't see too much upside unless they can prove there was technical incompetence or they ignored their own rules. If it's about the sentence itself, then they'll probably take that away. And they want it. I think everybody just wants to draw a line underneath this and move on. But it is really, when you step back from this and you look at Volke, Platini and Blatter, like 10 months ago, who would have thought these three guys would have been banned from the sport for extended number of years? It's incredible.
I think one of my favorite parts of this whole thing that's going to happen tomorrow is the official name. The 2016 FIFA Extraordinary Congress. Has the irony of the use of extraordinary, has that escaped your attention here?
No, what got me thinking about it when I saw that, John, was aren't really all of them extraordinary in some ways?
Right.
It's that kind of flamboyance, and they just can't have an ordinary Congress. They've got to have an extraordinary Congress. The thing that surprised me really about it, though, John, is they didn't put the little TM mark after extraordinary.
That's true. They didn't. So they did show some restraint. So that's, I guess, encouraging.
I have this vision of halfway through it, Sepp Blatter swinging from the rafters with the Phantom of the Opera mask on, you know, and cape flying behind him.
Well, did you hear? Apparently, the New York Times did an interview with him today in Switzerland.
Yeah,
I will always be president.
Yeah, I'll always be president.
It's like, come on.
I know. Oh, when he was asked about Bahrain and their human rights issues, he goes, well, you know, they're a kingdom, not a nation like other nations, so it's different for them. Oh, that makes it fun to torture people. All right, fair enough, they're a kingdom. All right, we'll turn a blind eye there, Sepp. Oh, it's incredible. Bobby, listen, we're out of time. Enjoy tomorrow. It's a nice early rise for us all to take in the festivities on FIFA.com. Can't wait. And thanks so much for this, mate.
Yeah, long live the king.
Yep. Check out Bobby on Twitter at BobbySoccerRep and on Forbes.com. Great article breaking down the nuts and bolts of all this nonsense happening on Friday in Switzerland. All right, J-Mo, the week that was in European football, interesting Champions League
actions. Very
interesting
week. Yeah.
Barcelona, in the end, they had a pretty easy go of it against Arsenal, who I thought actually played quite well. I'm never quite sure about those tactics, giving Barcelona the ball, but I don't know what tactics you really employ to beat Barcelona. But your thoughts on that performance by either team?
You know, I thought it was not, I wouldn't say a labored performance by Barcelona, but I think clearly, I mean, not necessarily at their best, but it was just, again, probably a testament to their strength and how good of a side that they were, that they did run out quite easily winners, 2-0 winners, without really kind of getting out of second gear. So, and that sort of first goal on the counter was, I thought, just brilliantly executed. And Flamini, I mean, I'm not sure what he's
just
thinking.
Comes on the field.
Yeah, it was, I think it was like 37 seconds or something like that. It was less than a minute, whatever it was.
What do you make of the sub to begin with? I mean, they needed to score.
Well, I think they were just looking to like limit the damage, right?
So they can go back to the Camp Nou and try and get them?
Well, I mean, look, at 1-0, I mean, it's, you know, you got to think that you at least have, there's the idea that you have at least some shot at the Camp Nou. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that's what their thinking was. Obviously, it didn't work out so well as he quickly gave up the penalty.
I know Wenger's been criticized, but quite frankly, when this draw came out, no one apart from those one-eyed Gunners fan thought they stood any chance. And like I said, I thought Arsenal defended pretty well through much of that game. But you just can't contain that front three for 90 minutes if you allow them the ball, which is what it was. Barcelona at 50% beat one of the top teams in English football, which just, I think, speaks for itself. Where do you put this Barcelona right now? We love watching when Pep brought Barcelona through and what they became with various players, but the spine obviously was Xavi in that team of Messi and Iniesta. Puyol was there as well. Yep. This team's different. They're coming off a treble. They're probably going to win at least another double this season. Where would you rate them compared to the previous Pep Guardiola Barcelona?
Oh, I think it's right there. I think if they repeat as Champions League winners, I think they'll absolutely succeed the previous Pep regime. I mean, important to remember that no team is repeated as European champion since AC Milan, in the late 1980s, early 90s. So to do that is going to be an incredible achievement. And if Luis Enrique pulls that off, then, I mean, I think they've already, to a certain degree, surpassed the previous Pep regime. But mm-hmm. if they cement it with a second UEFA Champions League title in a row, then I don't think there's any question that it'll be better.
Now, Pep advocates will argue that, well, this team still has the seeds that he planted.
Sure.
Right. I mean, the spine of that team is still Pep. Okay, there's Neymar now and the Suarez.
Right.
But, you know, Pep is still central to what this team has become. But I'm really happy for Luis Enrique. He's stepped into a pretty good situation there, obviously, but people did question the hire at first.
Sure they did. Absolutely.
He's got a treble already, and like I said, maybe another one on the way. Outstanding. Juventus.
Wow, that was a game.
What a game against Bayern Munich. You're down 2-0, and you come back, claw back to 2-2. It's a game of two halves, as they say, and what a performance.
By both teams. I mean, Bayern, where I think that was the best 45 minutes I've seen from them ever. I mean, they absolutely came into Turin and just barnstormed and dominated Juventus. And I mean, it was 1-0 at the half, but could have easily been 3. And, you know, they were pretty wasteful. And then when they went up 2-0 early in the second half, I just thought, well, the tie's over. There's no way Juventus is coming back. But credit to Allegri, because he made some key substitutions and they fought their way back into the game. Storaro and I thought, you know, he had that goal, obviously. And Mandzukic was very good in kind of holding up the play and linking up with Storaro and Morata, who was another substitute. And Dybala scored a crucial goal. So it was,
what a play he's becoming.
Yeah,
eh?
Very much so. So it was a great, I think a great performance by both teams, and just sets up nicely for the return leg in Munich in 2 weeks.
Yeah, people run off of Juventus, you know. Why would you? When you talk about the top teams in Europe, obviously
they're
Bayern,
one of them.
Barca, but just below them, they're absolutely up there.
Yeah.
You know, with the Real Madrids even, you know, and the, well, I'm not sure what in England you can compare them with. I don't think you can, actually.
Yeah, I think they're better than any team in England.
Yeah. Leicester, maybe.
Wow.
Still saying it. Love it. Man City, they beat Kiev 3-1.
Yeah.
They played pretty well. Kiev were dreadful for much of that game.
They were.
But overall, I thought Man City, despite being criticized recently for their form, and so they should have been, stepped up and looked very good.
They did. I wrote about this yesterday. I thought it was a coming of age performance in a lot of senses, because, you know, when the 2-0 lead, and then Kiev scored early in the second half to get it 2-1, and then they were kind of, you know, dominating the game for, you know, that final 30 minutes, and you thought, are City going to buckle and they're going to concede, you know, another one? And, you know, here they had a 2-0 lead, and it looks like, you know, they're going to, you know, settle for a draw, but they didn't buckle, and then they withstood the pressure, and then they got that late goal from Yaya Toure, which was stupendous.
Great
after,
goal.
After he did, you know, very little in all the game. So I liked it, the way that it was a very professional performance for Man City. They saw it out, and, you know, a 2-goal lead going back to England, I think the job done.
See, Yaya was tweeting soon after, you know, what a nice evening it was, and how he enjoyed himself. Like, Yaya's finally doing something once again, yeah. And he's back on social media. That guy.
Well, wow. He won't be there for much longer.
He won't be. I'm sure some team will throw a lot of money at him, though, and he'll probably do a job for them while he's happy.
Yeah.
Atletico PSV 0-0. PSV pretty fortunate in that one. Down a man, of course. And
yeah.
In that first half, it was all Atletico as well.
Right.
They're pretty decent.
Well, Atletico is just incredibly difficult to break down. I think they've only conceded like 11 or 12 goals in La Liga.
Incredible.
Like
so that, many so. Clean sheets. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 11 in the last, I'm going to say 17 games is a clean sheet or something.
Yeah. It's the, you know, I think I saw a stat like 68% of the games that they played in all competitions this year, they've kept a clean sheet. So, I mean, they're tough. And Simeone is just, yeah, I think he's done a wonderful job there and really sort of built them up into, you know, one of the top teams in the world. We were talking about Juventus. I think I would put Atletico de Madrid up there as well. They've been spectacular. And this in the league where they've got to compete against the likes of Real and Barcelona. Yeah.
And they led that league for much of the season there.
Did, yeah.
Second place now, but still up on Real Madrid.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting because you hear all the talk about Antonio Conte being linked with Chelsea, but, you know, you often wonder if, you know, Simeone, would he ever make the move, and should they be going after him?
Yeah. But what is the right fit for Simeone? Because it seems Atletico is the perfect team for him, a team of underdogs,
yeah.
A team that he can make feel better than they actually are.
I think the other thing too, James, is the whole, I mean, one of Simeone's strengths is his character, and he's able to communicate so well with you know, the players and get that intensity across. I wonder, you know, how much the language barrier would be a problem if he moved to England, right? Because he, you know, he'd have to speak English and
just bring in a bunch of Spanish players.
Yeah, well,
kick all the English guys out.
Yeah, I suppose.
For starters, that's a good beginning.
Well, sure. But I just wonder if it would necessarily be him going to England would be a good fit.
Yes, interesting. Yeah.
You know, because as I said, I think one of his main attributes is just his communication skills and mm-hmm. getting across that intensity. And I wonder if he'd be able to do that in England. But who knows?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of his big personality and yeah, done a great job there. You mentioned Conte and the rumors to Chelsea. It's a bit like Mourinho to United. The media is talking as if it's a done deal.
Yeah.
And often in these cases, it is. I like the signing myself. He's obviously done a great job with Juventus when they came out of the doldrums of the ban.
Yep.
And dominated Italian football. Although during that time, and nothing against Juventus, but Inter Milan were struggling through a tough time, right? As were Milan, Napoli, Lazio. But still, he got the job done. He built a great team. Mm-hmm. And I think he's done a pretty good job at Italy as well. I think he'd be a superb fit at Stamford Bridge.
I do. I think I agree. I think he'd be... he's the kind of manager who doesn't suffer fools gladly. So I think all the sort of shenanigans going on over there with Costa and Hazard and guys kind of complaining in the media about, you know, such and such, I don't think that would wash over there. I think he would sort of not necessarily rule with an iron fist, but he wouldn't sort of tolerate all that stuff. And I think he'd get them well organized and sort of focused on the matter at hand. And I think he's a passionate guy. I mean, you ever watch him on the sidelines?
Oh, yeah, it's great.
He's very excitable. So I think they could use a little bit of that.
Did he rebuilt Juventus, didn't he? Pretty much.
How do you mean rebuilt?
Like he brought a lot of players in, did he not?
Yeah, I think, well, there was that.
Out of the ban.
Yeah, I think there was that, but I think more so what he brought to them tactically, right? Because he was the one who really sort of instituted that 3-5-2 that they played with.
But I'm just thinking, though, at Chelsea, they need a rebuild,
yeah.
Right? They've got to bring a lot of players in and move a lot of players out. Is he the right guy for that?
Oh, I think so. I think he's proven to be an astute evaluator of talent mm-hmm. and knowing what a team needs and who to bring in. So yeah, I don't think he would, I think he would fit in quite nicely at Chelsea in that regard.
He brought in Paul Pogba to Juventus too from United. I forget, they're pretty tight.
Yeah. Although, yeah, well, yeah, there's that. Although, you know, I still scratch my head over that one as to, you know, what Sir Alex Ferguson and Man United were thinking.
I don't know.
Sometimes you get it wrong, right?
I mean, I guess so. Yeah. And who knows, the agents were at play there as well. And
sure.
But it seems very un-Fergie-like to let
Absolutely.
That kind of talent escape him.
I'm sure I don't know if anyone's ever asked him about this. I'm sure they have, and I may have missed it. But I have to think that's probably one of Ferguson's big regrets, right? Because yeah. that's a once-in-a-lifetime player, much like, you know, he had when he had Ronaldo there. So yeah. to let Pogba leave for nothing, that's the killer.
Who's
too.
Worth it was what? Like 80 million now?
Yeah, Who at knows, least, right? You know? And you let him walk for nothing, and Juventus got him. So it's
well, Chelsea, they say all the reports you read and those in the inside say they're going to spend money this summer to rebuild. Roman's going to invest in a rebuild, and well, Pogba is available by all accounts, and we assume he's going to Man City, right? Everyone does,
or Barcelona, well, or you know, yeah. there's going to be. I don't think I'm sure Chelsea would love to have Pogba, and who wouldn't? But I think there's going to be many suitors this offseason.
Yeah, but they're the one, probably the one of the three or four teams that can afford him, right?
Sure.
Look at Barcelona. You look at Man City. Real can't sign players.
Right.
PSG, obviously. And then you've got Chelsea, right?
Yeah.
Man U, I suppose, good. But be surprised if that happened.
It'll be interesting. I mean, I wouldn't even... I mean, this is going to sound crazy, but I wouldn't even rule out Juventus keeping him for like yeah. another year.
Yeah. Allegri's staying there, right?
Well, that's another interesting one, too, because they're talking about if Conte moves to Chelsea... then I don't know how the two are linked, but there was reports about, well, if Conte leaves, then, you know, Pellegrini would be a good fit at Juventus.
So Allegri's going to the Azzurri?
Yeah, I mean...
Who's the Italian next coach? I haven't seen anything about
that. Well, that's an interesting one, too.
I'm assuming it's Lippi.
I would think he would... Well, you know, he's kind of talked about it wanting to come back, and, I mean, what's Capello doing? He's sort of...
What is Capello doing?
I don't know. Is he in the Middle East somewhere?
Middle East or China?
Or China?
One of those.
He might be.
He must be, right?
So,
although he's probably still collecting a massive pay packet from England
and Russia,
as well. Yeah.
So I don't know. It's an interesting sort of managerial go around that we'll have to watch this season as to who lands where.
Let's wiki it. Let's find out right now. So Fabio Capello.
Now this is compelling listening.
It is, isn't it? Well, it's because our next guest just texted me and he's a little bit delayed.
Oh, so we're just treading water here. I gotcha. That's nice.
Oh, it's coming. Okay, Capello. He is, you know, he's most recently head coach of Russia, so he is not working.
Oh, so he didn't take another
apparently.
Job? Okay.
I thought he was in China or somewhere. Anyway, He's not.
Speaking of China, that might be a good idea for a future show, because that is
what's going on there.
Like blowing up, right?
And is MLS concerned? I mean, they're stealing all the targets that you would think would be MLS targets.
Well, but Femi Martin's going there for like ridiculous money on a, I think it's like a 6-year deal. So
it can't sustain itself.
I wouldn't.
This is just insane.
I wouldn't think so. And I get the impression that this is just like one or two kind of owners over there really kind of blowing their brains out. And I don't get the sense that it's, you know, a league-wide initiative of teams, you know, spending big. But you see some of the names, like Ezekiel Lavezzi's going there now. And, okay, he's not 28.
Big enough name, though.
But
that's
a pretty big name.
He's not over his hill.
And he's got enough gas left in the tank. Sure. So, and Obafemi Martins was, I think, one of the best players in MLS.
It's a big loss for MLS, that is.
Very big loss.
But they now signed Antonio Nocerino, right, in Orlando. So, he's fine.
But I do wonder about how, you know, the sort of the rise of the Chinese League and the money there, how is that going to affect MLS? It'll be very interesting to watch.
I wonder, I think we mentioned before, are they hiring media? Because if they want to pay media.
Oh, I see.
Enormous amounts of money.
You're available?
I'd consider it. I would consider it.
Yeah, well.
I can be bought.
Well, that's nice. You'd work in well at FIFA then, too.
Wouldn't I? We should move on. Well, as we know, Canada is an emerging force, I think, in world football. It's taken a while, but we saw the women recently in Olympic qualifying, getting the job done. And on the men's side, qualifying resumes for the World Cup later in March against Mexico. Now, beneath the men, of course, there's various age groups, including the U20s. And it's interesting and a fascinating topic to discuss in these parts. So we're joined now by Rob Gale, head coach of the U20s. Rob, to begin with, we're just talking about FIFA before you came on the show here, and of course, what to expect tomorrow in the elections. As a professional involved at the highest level of the game in this country, what are your thoughts on the shenanigans at FIFA?
Oh my goodness, where do you start? It's been a circus, unfortunately, and let's just hope that doesn't continue tomorrow and they can move forward behind. I mean, you look at the US elections, I'm not sure what's crazier at the moment, but I've got Smithy as my vote. I don't know if you saw that for sport release. But,
I did.
Smithy to see the president.
I did.
Could be as good a bet as anybody, but let's hope they can get their act together and really clean up the sport.
Now, Rob, it's been a few weeks since the U20 World Cup qualifying tournament didn't go according to plan. With a few weeks off, has it given you a different perspective on what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, last January, so we've had a good while to look back at it. And I think one of the biggest things going in with that squad is the expectations were a lot higher than normal. We'd sort of gone 2.5 years and conquered all kinds of teams. Good results, beat USA, beat Mexico, tied England. So expectancy levels were there internally and externally. And unfortunately, with CONCACAF, there was a late change in venues. And when you're planning sort of a 2-year periodized plan and cycle, it's very difficult with budgets and everything else to change. And what we really found was the January time frame and the players having almost 2.5 months off from their last competitive action. It's very difficult for them in that off season to then try and peak in a qualification tournament. Whereas a lot of the other players were still playing, you know, the likes of Mexico had players in their first team and getting regular games. So I think we've learned many lessons about that. And obviously you always learn, individually and collectively. I think it's been a great experience for players like Marco Bustos, Kian Throw, Sam Adekugbe, who I just saw all out in Portland yesterday with the Whitecaps, and that they've learned lessons from what to do in the off-season now and how to better prepare themselves in those 2 months. And that's part of being a professional footballer and the lessons that these young under-20 players, they're still young lads developing in the game, so they're going to make mistakes, and collectively we hope to pass those lessons on to the next group and see if we can improve.
You talked there briefly, Rob, about sort of raised expectations going into the tournament. What did you make of that, about the expectations that everyone had? Because as you alluded to, you beat some pretty formidable teams. And it's not often that there are positive expectations for Canadian national teams. So just wondering what it was like to deal with that from a tournament perspective.
you know what, we embraced it, to be honest. And if you look at the games, I mean, three games you lose by an odd goal. One of them was a last-minute set piece. A couple, you know, sort of individual errors. So the margins at that level are very, very slim between winning and losing. And I think just that readiness, that sharpness. But that's something that these players need to deal with. And that was something we went through with them, and the social media and everything that comes with that. It's a great learning experience. And ultimately, that's what you want for these youth players. That's why we have the tours. That's why we want to qualify for tournaments. And obviously World Cup, so that they get more experience. It's not just about the end result with the youth levels. It's about what these players can take from that and build, and hopefully then go on and become full-time professionals and make our senior men's national team. So I thought it was terrific. I thought they handled themselves well, and really the confidence came from within, because we knew we were capable of beating anybody on our day.
Now, obviously, you're missing some key players too, though. Dylan Carrera was out, and Fraser Aird, who their clubs refused to release them. do you find Canada gets a lack of respect internationally? I mean, I'm assuming if they were English players or Italian players or Spanish players, it wouldn't be in question that they'd be released.
You know what? I don't think so. To be fair, I've got lots of colleagues. My brother-in-law is an England international coach, and he has the same battles, same really? Politics, same fights, club versus country. And, you know, until be it CONCACAF or whoever recognize these tournaments and on FIFA dates, and it becomes part of that mandate, every country is going to go in missing players. Obviously, with us, the talent pool and the players playing at the senior level, we don't have as many as others, so when you don't get them, then it can be a blow. But I honestly feel we had the quality with other players. It's got to be the next man up scenario and not hide behind that. We lost some leadership, but it was a great opportunity for the players who stepped into that role, and they'll have learned from it and hopefully take that back to their club programs now.
Rob, you talked earlier about sort of developing these players, just for obviously club level, but also internationally. You know, eventually you want to see as many as many of them as you can going on to the senior team. I'm interested to hear your take. I mean, from a development perspective, should what you're doing, should it be tied to how Benito Floro currently likes to play with the senior team, or is it about getting these kids to learn a number of different tactical systems and being a little bit more flexible?
I mean, both, I would say. I think we do have a good relationship with the senior team, and Benito and Tony Fonseca work closely together. Mike Finley, who's been an assistant with the youth teams, and myself before, is Benito's assistant. So we're always looking for synergies within that. But ultimately, for Benito, he's going to be results-based. That's the nature of senior men's football. In the youth, for us, it is about the bigger picture and the long-term development of these players and giving them more tools, I would say, to then be adjustable for any coach that comes in. You know, the shelf life, it's like a club, can be very short sometimes.
Sure.
And if you pigeonhole them to certain tactics or a level of play, we have to, if we're going to be better on the world stage, we need players that are good decision making, technically competent, tactically versatile, so that we can change within games, change the system, change defensive or attacking tactics. The principles of the game don't really change. I think sometimes we label systems, etc., but what's ultimately is going to be down to the quality of the player and their adaptability within games and within structures to be able to work with any coaches, and that will stand them in good stead throughout their careers.
Now, you know, you said in the past, obviously, you know, technical ability, tactics are, you know, paramount, so important, but you've also said in the past that having fun is still crucial no matter what level you're playing at, be it, you know, you're a kid or a full-fledged professional national team player. Let me ask you, at your age group you're dealing with, U20s, a lot of those kids are under pressure. You know, they're probably facing a bit of a crossroads in their careers about, do I go pro? Do I not go pro? What are the avenues? A lot of stress. Is it hard sometimes for these kids to have fun playing the game?
I don't think it's hard for them to, and it's more enjoyment. You know, fun can cover any number of sins, I think, but they've got to still enjoy going out onto the field every single day, putting 100% in, because otherwise they're not going to make professional careers. So I think the enjoyment factor of the game and everything else is vital. Now, absolutely, there's a lot of stresses in this time of their lives, as there is anyone finding, you know, work in the workplace and trying to find your pathway. But we do try and pass on the lessons that we've learned. The former players, obviously, Paul Stalteri, Ante Jazic, who worked with me in the program. So we have a lot of experience of that from all over the world. And we try and guide them through all of the factors that are going to be important in their career. And for us, that's really important. But when you're representing your national team, you know, we want that passion, we want that winning mentality, and we want it to be a positive experience for them. So we really try and cultivate that group feel, really get to become a family on and off the field, because ultimately then you're going to go and want to battle for the man next year in the same shirt.
Rob, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you don't want to sort of name names, but of the current crop of U20ers, who are you most excited about? Who do you think has a very good chance of going on to become, A, very good professionals, and B, mainstays with the national team going forward?
I wish I had that crystal ball, but you never know with youth development and injuries and everything else, obviously, that happens. But what I really like about this group, some of the other players in the last group were starting to get a little bit well known. This group has flown under the radar a bit more, and there is a collective feel to that. You know, most coaches will say that you don't want to single out names and everything else, but I believe the team is going to be the key with this group rather than certain individuals. Now, there's talented players, obviously, between the five clubs here in Canada. There's a few overseas. People have mentioned, like, Balu Tabla. What's going to be interesting for Balu is that he is eligible for the next two under-20 cycles. So he's one at Montreal Impact that has some good qualities. We have Fakayo Tomori, who's come into our group, who's overseas with Chelsea and doing quite well with their under-21 program. But I think the key with this group is definitely there's more collective. I don't think there's anyone who's sort of broken into first teams or had opportunities and been in the public eye so far. So it's definitely going to be a group effort.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a sense of optimism now around Canadian soccer that perhaps haven't seen for a while. Obviously, the men's team doing decent to start qualifying. The girls obviously do well in the Olympic qualifying, despite losing to the States. But there is certainly hope anyway. So there's something. Rob, thanks so much for this, mate. Appreciate it. And good luck going forward.
No, my pleasure anytime. And, yep, we keep wanting those fans. We're hoping to inspire them, as the ladies' teams have done. And the clubs are doing a great job, I got to say, across Canada now. And it's becoming more professional. So we're only going to get better and better as time goes on.
For sure. Thanks, Rob.
Take care, chaps.
That is Rob Gale, head coach of the Canada Men's Under-20s. Do you feel hope, a little bit of hope, compared to... I know, listen, I'm being realistic here.
Sure.
I understand. I still don't think they're going to qualify for the World Cup, the men. But I feel more hope now than perhaps I did a couple of years ago.
Well, certainly since 8-1, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you would have told me they would have taken 4 points from their first two games, I wouldn't have thought that. So, yeah, I think there's hope.
Yeah.
Now, whether it leads to anything tangible, I think we're going to quickly find out during these two back-to-back games against Mexico. If they can come out of that.
The point.
Yeah, or even more, I mean, well, then I think that would.
That's asking a lot, isn't it?
Well, it is, but, you know, you got to ask these questions, right? You got to expect. Otherwise, what's the point? So, we'll see. We'll see. Like I said, I think we're going to find out quickly just how good this Canadian national team is.
We will get into depth about those big games against Mexico in the coming weeks on the podcast.
We will.
J-Mo, thank you.
No problem.
We're back this weekend across Sportsnet. Check out sportsnet.ca for our Premier League coverage and Bundesliga coverage. And as always, sportsnet.ca is the place for all things footy, no matter the league or the level. We have you covered.
We got it covered.
We got you covered. Thanks, everyone. Cheers for listening.